This is Speaking of Faith's Unheard Cut. I'm Krista Tippett. You are listening to my unedited conversation with Bishop Vashti McKenzie of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. I spoke with her using a broadcast-quality telephone connection on September 22, 2008. I was in the studio of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she was in a private recording studio in Nashville, Tennessee. This interview was included in our program, African American Woman Leader, and originally podcast in October 2008. Download the MP3 of the produced show at speakingoffaith.org.
No, I doubted that you'd get here today. That's what
I'm sorry.
No, because I called you yesterday to tell you that that concert is tonight. Dara Williams.
Oh, I saw that. I'm not going to make it. It's at the Guthrie, isn't it? It's probably pretty expensive, too. At the Guthrie.
Especially if you go by yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Rub it in, Mitch. Yeah. Yeah, who liked... No one who wants to spend their off hours with me. Thank you. Thank you. I know you're paid to be here with me, so.
Taking over everything.
I saw that you called. So we need to do this in an hour. Is that right? I'm gonna try to. I know she's got busy schedule, right. But we have 90 minutes.
Ten, it's gonna be an hour and a half.
Where are they?
It said 9 to 10:30. That's why I said they really have a whole lot to talk about.
You have a lot to say, or you will.
I guess I will, right?
And here's your headphone volume right here.
Okay.
And we'll get a level on you here. Just a second. Let me see. We need that up just a little bit more.
All right.
Bishop McKenzie?
Yes.
Hi, it's Krista Tippett.
Hi, Krista. How are you?
Hello. I'm so glad I managed to get you at the other end of the microphone.
It's been a challenge, I know. It's been a challenge.
But I've...
It's been a busy year.
I know it has. I'm just grateful that you're here today. I've known for years that I wanted to interview you. I've had you on my list, and I thought this year was the moment. So.
Oh, okay.
And Krista? Engineer Dave here. Before we get too far into it, let's get a level on everybody here.
Okay.
Bishop, if you would talk to me.
Sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 on Monday.
Mitch, look all right?
Looks great, Dave. Thank you.
Am I hearing a little bit of an echo? No. It's fine. Well, tiny. I can live with it. I think it's only when I move up too close to the microphone. No, I'm not hearing anything now. Okay. Bishop McKenzie, do you have any questions of me before we start?
Sure. Just tell me a little bit about your broadcast and the audience. And you're on,
Okay. I am hearing a little bit of an echo. I wonder if, Mitch, do you think that might be headphones at the other end? I wonder, can Dave hear me?
Would you like me to turn them down?
Yes, just a little bit if you could. You've done this before.
I can see.
I think that's better. Yeah. Okay. So this program, Speaking of Faith, it's a relatively new media enterprise. We've been on public radio for 5 years. We're on over 200 stations. We just won a Peabody. So the program's grown really rapidly, but it's quite a new thing for public radio to have a program devoted to religion.
Okay.
And we have a very diverse audience. We have a lot of podcasters. I mean, these days, anything you do is global automatically through the internet. So we have listeners all over the world.
And
What I like to say is that this is not a program about religion, but about any subject of life. We can take on any subject of life, of public life or human life, but then throw a different set of questions and a different set of insights at it. Mm-hmm. And
you have to give me a minute to cough here. This is allergy season.
Yes.
You know, you stepped outside of the house and I went like, whoa, whatever is decomposing or blooming, it got me today.
Well, you can cough as much as you want. a great luxury of this is we're not a live program. We get to have a real conversation, and you can stop and cough whenever you feel like it's not a problem. Okay. We can just edit it out. So
I'm just clearing the pipes.
Okay, no, do that. Yeah. I wanted to talk to you. I've been longing to talk to you this year because I feel like you embody and bring together in your person. You are a woman. You are African American. You are a leader. And in our culture this year, in the context of the presidential election, some of those qualities have been sort of pitted at odds, pitted against each other in strange ways. And, you know, you've brought them together in your life. And I do want to, a little bit later on, talk about some of the issues that have come up or questions maybe that we haven't really faced that have been opened through the candidacy of Barack Obama, the candidacy of Hillary Clinton, the Jeremiah Wright controversy. But I don't want to start there. I really just want to start with
Thank
an
you.
Understanding. I want that not to be the point, but we'll get there. So I want to learn about you and your life and your theology and your philosophy of leadership, which is pretty developed. So that's where we'll start. Is that all right?
Okay, that's fine.
Okay,
that's good.
So and I do, you know, I interview theologians, I interview physicists, I interview parents, but I always start with this question. I'd like to hear something about the religious background of your childhood and how it formed you and what it meant to you.
Well, I believe, and I have said on a number of occasions, that I grew up as a church child. Not that my parents were pastors or, you know, deacons or that. I just grew up in the church, meaning that at an early age I was in Sunday school. I was going to worship on a regular basis. The bus system, you know, I grew up in the heart of Baltimore City.
Right.
And the, you know, the public bus system was like, you know, 10 cents to the church and 10 cents back.
Okay.
It was easy for me after school, which was, of course, in those days was right down the street, to come home and you have working parents. And so for me, I'm on the bus to the church. I started singing in the choir before I could read. I would go to choir rehearsal on Thursdays and memorized the songs and kind of insisted on being in the choir on Sunday since I knew the songs, and I would stand there and hold the hymn book or hold the folder where the music was, and people said, oh, wow, she can read. No, I just went to memorize the songs because I wanted to sing in the choir.
Oh.
And so I you know, grew up in the church that way and went through the youth fellowship. We used to have sock hops in the Guildhall in growing up. So, you know, just surrounded by, you know, church activities growing up. And it had a great impact upon me, being able to sit in the sanctuary. There was always a sense. There was always a presence for me. At that age, of course, I could not identify it. I could not put my hand on it, but I knew that there was a presence. And when I was in the sanctuary, I could feel the presence. Of course, now at an older age, looking back, I could feel the presence of the Lord. And at that young juncture, you know, you're talking about back in the early 60s, late 50s, I had many questions. I wanted to know how come the girls couldn't do this when the guys could do this. You know, I had an older brother.
Was it an AME church that your family attended?
In the Episcopal Church. My childhood was in the Episcopal Church. And, you know, my brother served on the altar and did all these other kinds of things. And I wanted to do that, too. And I couldn't understand why I could not. do that, but that was not the question that I asked at that time. My family's history is in the African Methodist Episcopal Church.
Okay.
My grandfather was a member of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and so was my grandfather, my great-grandfather. In fact, my great-grandfather was a trustee for 15 years, led the senior choir for 15 years, was Sunday school superintendent of the Hagerstown District at that time in the Baltimore, in the state of Maryland, and so was a great supporter. And many of my family members were members of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. We got kind of, we took a right turn when my mother was one of five girls.
Right.
She was the second oldest. And after her came a set of twins. So my grandmother's hands were kind of full with young children and young babies. And so my grandmother asked my mother's godmother to take her to church. And my mother's godmother was a member of the Episcopal Church. And so that's how we got there. And then when I became grown and an adult, I chose the African Methodist Episcopal Church because it was closer to my belief system.
I see. Now, in terms of what people, the passions and the careers of people in your family, there was a, you were surrounded by journalists, right? And people, political and cultural issues. It sounds like more than religion, perhaps religion was always in the mix. And but it, I mean, it sounds to me just from reading you that you didn't really imagine growing up that you would end up as a preacher or much less as a bishop. Is that right?
Absolutely. If you had asked me 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, if you had asked me that question, I would say, no, absolutely not. I did not intend originally to have a career in journalism. I grew up with it. It was all around me. Of course, parents and other family members were very encouraging. But I said, well, everybody else is doing this. I want to do something different. But lo and behold, guess what? Here I am. I started writing professionally at 16. I had my own column in the family newspaper and took a stint at the Arizona Republic after I got married, and just kind of stayed close to journalism until I ended up in broadcasting, in radio. I was on air for, 10, 12 years on radio, and went into broadcast management. And my sights, really, I was on my way from on-air personality to program director to operations manager to general manager. And I was looking to own a slew of radio stations at this time of life, at this time of my life.
And you, there's a sentence in one of your books, but you don't really elaborate on it. You say, I preached my trial sermon at Bethel AME Church in Baltimore. My friends and family sat in the congregation thinking I had lost my mind at any moment. I would snap out of it. Is this because they had really never pictured you in that role either?
Well, they caught what I was, where I was going. Why would you leave a career where you're successful in broadcast management, downsize your career, a very wonderful salary, a very wonderful rating, and, you know, back up and go to seminary.
Yeah.
You
How
have
old
to
were
prepare
you?
For this.
How old were you when you went to seminary?
This had to be, now you're asking very deep, complicated questions.
You don't have to answer anything you don't want to.
This had to be somewhere in the late 20s, early 30s.
Okay.
You know, when you're making these career decisions, you know, and, you know, like, why would you do that? Why would you do that? But I was in gospel radio. I was an on-air gospel announcer at a 24-hour gospel radio station. And I believe that every believer has a call in their life, that wherever you, whatever you do, your faith response is to do something for the Lord. So if your call is to usher, your ushering should be your ministry. If you're singing in the choir, you're the psalmist ministry. If you work in other kinds of ministry, that every believer has a responsibility to be a part of a ministry. And so I thought at the time when I was on air. I said, this is the ministry that God has called me to. How wonderfully perfect. I would do it even if you wouldn't pay me. I would do it for free. And I thought I was just the most blessed person in the world to do something that I enjoyed, I loved doing, and people actually paid me for it. They must have been deluded, but they did. And so my family felt that I was just, you know, I was going to follow this course and go, you know, straight right out of broadcasting to ownership, because it's what I talked about.
That's what your family had done as well. Your family had a great history in that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of fit. It was kind of natural. And then all of a sudden, you know, as they say, you know, there's a stop there. And, you know, are you really sure? You know, they thought maybe I had overdosed on gospel music. I'd just been at it, you know, 6 days a week, on air for 4 or 5 hours. And then, of course, programming and working and doing everything. So they thought that any moment now I would come to my senses. But that was not it. The call for me was beyond what I was doing as a vocation. The call was for me to come into ministry, that this was not the end. This was just the beginning. It was a stop along the way.
Okay. And you have also written that you've, and I wrote this sentence down because the way you phrased it, I think, is really important, that you learned how to endure when caught in the crossfire of racism and sexism, both of those things. And, I just wonder if you think from your earliest days how you experienced that crossfire between sexism and racism.
Well, I have been female and African American all my life. Mm-hmm. And someone asked me a question the other day, has there ever been a time where you have felt, have been in a place where there was an absence of racism and absences of sexism? And I said, no, I don't remember a time where you didn't have to face that issue. I have. When I look back over the places where I've been in life, I have not been in traditionally places, roles, functionalities that were traditionally female, except for I think one time. Mm-hmm. But doing morning drive was not time in the 60s a traditional place for a woman to be. Okay. Doing afternoon drive was not a place for a woman. Being a program director in a major market, Washington D.C. I mean, for a radio station, and we got good ratings, yay! Mm-hmm. But that was not a traditional role for women, and so being a general manager radio station at the time was not a traditional role for a woman. So to be able to face the jokes, you'd come into work and you're going off shift and you're program director now. So now you're going off shift and you're going to handle the administrative responsibilities and duties, and the next person coming behind you, I give a little reminder. I said, don't forget to leave the studio the way you found it. So the next person who comes behind you, will be able to, step into the seat and get their music going and go right on. Yeah. The young man said to me, you can't tell me what to do because a woman is not supposed to tell a man what to do. And I said, excuse me. I'm your program director. I signed your checks, pardon me. And he says, well, the Bible says that a wife is supposed to submit herself to her husband. Okay. And I said, am I married to you? And he says, no, then make sure the studio looks like this when you go off shift. And it's those kinds of things that you face on a daily basis. You're sitting in a staff meeting and you come up with a great idea for a promotion and all the guys in the room laugh and they think it's a really big joke. Oh, no, this will never work. And then about a month later, one of the guys is sitting in the room and say, hey, why don't we do this? This would be a great idea for a promotion. And you go like, wait a minute, didn't I suggest that 3 weeks ago? No. This is different. Those kinds of things. And when you're talking about being caught in the crosshairs of racism and sexism, it becomes very disappointing when you believe that you're holding hands with your brothers who are of African descent, who you believe that together we're going to help open the doors for the generation that are coming behind us. Mm-hmm. And together we're going to help our communities become colorblind. And together we're going to work to be sure that people don't look at our color first, but they look at our skills, our qualifications, our education, our background, that we can find purchase, not because of our color or our color, we're going to find our place because our gifts are going to make room for us. And then all of a sudden, the hand that you're holding turns around and closes the door in your face because you're a woman. Mm. See, yeah. And so that what it means is being in the crosshairs. It's sort of like a double whammy. You know, you get, bam, you get hit because of your color, and then you get hit again because of your gender.
Now, you were, is this right, you were in sixth grade when integration arrived in Baltimore?
Yes.
How did that imprint your sense of what it meant to be African-American culturally? I mean, did that make you more aware of your race than you had been before?
Yes. I believe that, growing up in Baltimore, we were in a very wonderful community where we knew everybody in the neighborhood, and it was a wonderful, affirming place. In school, your school teachers were likely to be the same persons who were your Sunday school teachers. And there was it's like a unit between the church, the school, and the community. It was a wonderful incubator, wonderful incubator. Then all of a sudden, integration comes. And excuse me.
That's okay. Do you have some water there? Do you have a cup of water? Okay, all right. Mm-hmm.
That's the way to say stop tape.
Mm-hmm. It's all digital now. It's great.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we can. This is no problem.
Work miracles everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, then all of a sudden, integration comes, and we are bused across town to a new school where instead of being a part of a majority, you are a part of a minority. Mm-hmm. There may be one, you may be the only person who is of African descent in your class. There may be two or three of you. I don't remember. I believe there were only about 7 to 10 kids in this humongous elementary school where I finished the sixth grade. And, of course, they couldn't get my name right. I was Vashti, and I kept saying, no, I'm Vashti, or you're Washti, and the kids in the class, well, why didn't your mother name you Mary or Ann like the rest of us? Because my name is not Mary or Ann like the rest of you. It is Vashti. Well, we have to find a name. We have to call you something. We just can't call you your name. And then all of a sudden, you become an oddity, and there was really a new experience. You find yourself in a position where you have to teach people about your culture and your heritage because they didn't know.
That's not an easy thing to do when you're in sixth or seventh or eighth grade, when you're wrestling with your identity at such a fundamental level as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that point, you find that you have to prove yourself every day. Mm-hmm. Before then, you were just you. Here you are. You're in class with teachers that you have known and grown up, and they're part of your family's social circle, your church circle, and who looked at you and expected you to do great things. Then you're thrust into an environment where people don't expect you to do great things. Mm-hmm. In fact, they expect you to fail. They look for you to fail. They look for you to be in the lowest reading group. They look for you to do the worst in math. And so all of a sudden, the light clicks on and says, oh, well, now, wait a minute here now. We're not used to being on the bottom of anything. We're used to being on the top. And so you find yourself, we're going to have to, step up here. We're going to have to upgrade our process because we're not used to being on the bottom. And so you find you have to prove different. Hmm. When people walk in with low expectations and attitudes like we really don't expect you to to get out of this class. And inside you says, oh, well, you got another thing coming. Not only am I going to get out of this class, but I'm going to get out of this class at the top.
And you did, I suspect.
Yeah. Everything. The school was wonderful because it had a whole lot of other things that we didn't have. I was at Robert Brown Elliott School number 104, which at the top of the school in stone, it said Colored School number 9. All we had was a playground and a cafeteria. Now, we were bused across town, which means I got on a bus at 6 a.m. To be in school by 8:30. And the kids that I had to go to compete with stayed in bed until 7. See, yeah. So, I mean, like the day started earlier, but at this new school, there was a gymnasium. We never had a gymnasium before. They had a band, the whole nine yards, track and field outside, out back. I mean, it was like, wow. You know, they had all these kinds of things that we didn't have in our elementary school, which was great, which was wonderful, you know, but I was already taking piano lessons. And so when I got to that school, they says, well, we already have a student playing piano. You have to learn another instrument. I said, okay, fine. You take the test and says, qualify for 1, 2, and 3. I said, I'll take the flute. I'll do that one. Oh, well, we want you to do the piccolo. Okay, fine. We'll do that one. Would you like to learn the oboe? Okay, fine. We'll do that, you know. And you find that in every place that you're put, you have to prove your existence. That you have a right to be there. And that's what African Americans, and that's what women do every day in a leadership position. Hmm. You have to prove that you have a right to be there.
You know, I just want to repeat something you said. It's really simple, but it's really stunning that it was through the experience of integration that you first experienced yourself as a minority, as being in a minority.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's really startling.
As an African American and as a woman, I grew up in a family where, gender didn't matter. For you did what your gift, qualified you for. The fact that you have that gift, that God gave you that gift, was permission for you to use it and to exercise it. So there were no boundaries. There were no borders. There was no one saying that you can't do that, which was just a wonderful family to grow up in. And then you step out of the cocoon of that family, the cocoon of your neighborhood, out into the big wide world. And they say, well, I don't know. We'll decide what you can do. Yeah. And when we've made up our mind about you, we may give you permission to step out of the corner that we have designated for you.
Hmm. Now, you have many firsts in your CV, and one of them was that you were the first woman pastor leader of the historic Payne Memorial AME Church in Baltimore. And while you were there, you grew the number of worshipers. All those numbers that we might look at in our commerce-oriented society and say this is progress. But you also created nonprofits. The church became a hub that was working on issues like health care and welfare to work. And I want to ask you how that reflects your understanding of the gospel and of the place of the church in human life and in public life as well as individual life. How's that a reflection of your theology?
Sure. Yes, it is. And it is a reflection of the theology of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which is why I came home to the African Methodist Episcopal Church. The mission, feed the hungry. This is the mission of the AME Church. Feed the hungry, clothe the naked, cheer the fallen, encourage economic thrift, visit and tend to those who are mentally enabled, unabled, and so forth. I mean, there are 9 categories that cover your social, your intellectual, your economic, your physical presence and being in the church.
Nine categories in church teaching, or how does that Where does that
in
appear?
The mission.
Okay.
In the mission.
All right.
When you look at the mission and purpose of the AME Church, there are nine things.
Okay.
You know, seek out and save the lost, visit the sick, cheer the fallen, encourage thrift, economic thrift, housing, visit those who are in prison. And these are, these are biblically based. These
yes.
are not things that were just grabbed out of the air. When you go to Matthew, the 25th chapter, when Jesus says, when the people respond, when did we see you hungry? Yeah. When did we see you in prison? And the Lord's response is, as you have done it unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. So these things are not just grabbed out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the church ought to be a center of the community. And being in the community, then our responsibility are not only to those who are members of your church, our responsibility is also to those who live in the shadow of, I call it the shadow of your citadel. Mm-hmm. And so there is a neighborhood, there is a community of needs and beings. And so the church ought to respond to that. And being at Payne, and you must understand, every church I pastored, I was the first woman.
Okay.
It's not just Payne.
All right.
Every church along the way.
Okay.
I was the first woman to pastor that congregation. I'm excited to say that I was not the last woman pastor, as you go along. But being in Payne Memorial in that Northwest Baltimore area, that congregation, for the most part, people drove in from other neighborhoods to attend that congregation. They used to live around there, but they have moved. But they, for the most part, drove in. And so that's your drive-in congregation. But around that neighborhood, there was violence, there was crime, there was drug activity, there was prostitution. There were people who were hungry, people who were homeless on the street. So what are we supposed to do? Drive in, have our wonderful service, and go home?
Okay.
And not do anything to enhance the life of those who live around your congregation? And if they live around the church, then how come they're not members of the church? If there's power in the church, and I believe there is, if the power of God can transform my life, can transform the people who drive in, then that same power can transform the people in the neighborhood. And so then our job is to be sure that the power that is on the inside becomes the power that reaches the people on the outside. So that means you do more than have a food pantry where once a week people who are hungry can come with a sack and we give you non-perishable food items. You have to go beyond that. You know, it's like, I saw you last week. Now, what are you going to do this week to be sure you're not in my line next week?
Right.
What can we do to help you and empower you so that you're not back in this line?
And so that was
next
your
week.
Welfare to work programming that you started.
It's a natural lead-in.
Mm-hmm.
We began the outreach center. The outreach center, started with, of course, the food pantry and the clothes pantry, the traditional things that happen. And then we moved to helping people with their shut-off and cut-off notices. And then we became like the referral agency. I need help, okay? Let's see how we can connect you to the appropriate agency or organization in the community, in the city, that can help you with that need, because some people just can't navigate all the red tape that they face when they need help, or they don't know where to go to help, where to go to find help. And so the natural progression after doing all of those services, I mean, we were providing services for 5,000 families on a yearly basis.
Okay.
And then it kind of jumped up to about 10,000 families because of the policies of the city. The city was closing down housing, moving Section 8 people out to the suburbs. They were revamping neighborhoods, which impacted, our services. So the city's making changes and policies and decisions and expects us to pick up the pieces without consulting us. I don't think that's fair, but that's
okay.
Neither here nor there. But the natural progression was to move into a place where we train persons for jobs and, held their hands while they navigated, coming out of tennis shoes and jeans, and we had a professional clothes closet. We did soft skills, how to get your resume out, how to do an interview, how to do all those kind of things, and then go through the training program. But we did a whole lot of things that the contract with the state didn't require. We did GED preparation, adult basic education. Mm-hmm. We helped, you know, if you can't read what the job requires, then you're not going to get the job.
Right.
If you have a problem with math, it's going to be very, very hard for us to train you to be a nurse's assistant, because you're going to need the math to be able to read the thermometers and all the machines and all this other kind of stuff. So we did all of the prep work.
It really
that
helped
wasn't required.
Connecting the dots and helping people. Sorry, I've got the same issue. Helping people connect the dots.
Sure.
Very practical dots.
And it's called demonstrating the love of God in tangible and practical ways.
Okay. And you became a bishop out. That was your next move from Payne Memorial, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so now in the American Methodist Episcopal, African Methodist Episcopal Church, as in many Protestant churches, you feel a calling to run for you run for bishop. It's kind of a political process. It's not an appointment from on high. So tell me, did you start to feel that calling to a broader leadership in those experiences you're describing? Is that something you can
yes.
trace?
Yes. Yeah. I believe the call, I believe that there is a call to the episcopacy. I believe it's more than a decision. You just don't wake up in the morning and say, well, you know, I've done this long enough. It's yeah. time for me to go do something else, or you know, I'm ready for the next level of service. I believe that it's a call. It just says there's a call to preach, and there's a call to pastor. There's a call to teach. I believe there's a call to Episcopal service, because the road to being elected is not an easy one. It's not an easy one for your family. And it's not an easy one for you. It is a political process. You have to campaign. Every 4 years, the AME Church holds a general conference. There are delegates who come from all over the world, from, of course, the United States, the Caribbean, England, Europe, Africa, Canada. They come from all over the world, and they will elect Episcopal leaders. And so you have to present yourself to these delegates, because they're going to vote for you. And it means you're going to have to travel. You're going to have to go to outside of your
annual conference. You're going to have to hit the campaign trail.
Yeah, you got to hit the campaign trail. And that's exactly what you do. And there, of course, we have campaign workers, you got volunteers, you got T-shirts, you got banners.
Videos. I mean, you know, I heard you had a great video that greeted people at the convention, or a video about your work, about your life and ministry. Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is, how do I get the message to people beyond the political barriers? It's the same thing that the candidates are doing now.
Yeah.
How do I get my message to the delegates, to the people who are voting? Because you have to understand, in any political process, there are people who agree with you and there are people who disagree with you. There are those who want you and there are those who don't want you. And those who are for another candidate are going to set up roadblocks and barriers to keep your message from getting out, keep you from getting to certain places, to certain key leaders, to influencers, and so forth and so on. So the challenge is, how do I get my message beyond the traditional mode? And one of those ways was, of course, the videos that played in delegates' hotel rooms on a 24-hour basis. Yay.
Right. So you won. And, I mean, you were also campaigning as the first woman who would become bishop, and you succeeded.
Let me say this to that.
Okay.
I campaigned on a platform that said I have experience, I'm qualified, I have the skills, I have a track record. Take a look at what I've done and where I've been as an indication of what I can do and where I can take the church to the next level. That the visions and ministries that God has given us that have been enacted throughout our pastoral career are not just for one congregation and for one community. These are things that can be replicated all over the connection to be a help and a blessing to others. And so that's the campaign that I ran on.
Okay. And you were, go on. Mm-hmm.
And of course, there hadn't been a woman who was elected, and there was a move within our church. The lay organization voted and so forth and so on that we must elect a woman, in 2000. And they had a resolution, So if the train is going that way, okay, the train is going that way. But my campaign was on my track record, my experience. And I told people, don't elect me because I'm a woman.
Okay.
Elect me because I'm qualified to do the job. Elect me if you want me to be your bishop, because, one day I just might be. So, let's not just do this for cutified fanfare novelty. I haven't served all my life, haven't worked all my life to be a novelty, to be a token, anything, just to dress up the stage, to be the feminine presence and all of this kind of thing. Yeah. No. We have served, we have worked, we have a track record, we've got experience. And so, the church pulled together, people in the church pulled together a resolution that says, we're going to elect a woman. And they tried to get the resolution to pass the general conference, and it didn't. And then everybody said, oh, well, everything is lost, because there were two of us in the campaign. All is lost. We're not going to elect a woman. And I sat there and looked at the tally. It was going to take 800 to 900 delegate votes to elect a bishop, to elect anyone a bishop in that particular election. And 600 people had voted for the resolution.
Okay.
That means all I had to do was convince those 600 who voted to have a woman to vote for me.
Okay.
And then pick up 300 somewhere.
Those swing voters.
It sounds easy math, but that it was a hard thing to do. To be elected, and praise God, I was elected on the second ballot.
Okay. And it seems to me that you had a pretty challenging or at least stretching adventure. Your first appointment as bishop, you went to serve as the chief pastor of the 18th Episcopal District in Southeast Africa. And so you were in Lesotho and Swaziland, Botswana, Mozambique. I haven't seen you write much about that. I really, really spent a lot of time steeping myself in what I could find out there and your sermons. And there's not a lot. And it sounds to me like I think you just immersed yourself in being and doing. But tell me how that time in Africa, continued to evolve and shape, evolve and shape your theology and your understandings of ministry and leadership.
Well, Africa is and is a great place to do ministry. If you're called to serve and you're called to do ministry, Africa is just a great place to do it because there are so many needs. Yeah. And it's not difficult to convince people, we have a problem here. Yes, we have a problem. Now, let us all come together and see how we're going to solve the problem. They're going to say, yes, let's go, which is different, when you're in the United States and you say, have you noticed the neighborhood is decaying and we really ought to do something about it? And they'll say, we'll go home to the suburbs and we'll think about it. We'll come back. And when we have official board, we'll discuss it. You're in Africa and there was the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and you have in that southern region, you had 7,000 people dying every week, and church life is interrupted because pastors and people have to pull together resources to bury people, and you had children who were left by the roadside or who were left on the steps of hospitals that are already overburdened, and you have 10-year-olds raising their 3- and 5- and 6-year-old siblings because their parents are in various stages of death and dying. When you say, we need to do something about this, and the people says, yes, we need to do something about this. And can you help us do something about this? And so there are many needs, and it's a great place to do ministry. And we praise God we were able to do some things. But Africa is also a place that'll break your heart. I've seen poverty in the United States. I've seen what poor is. I know what it is. I've seen hunger here. I've seen homeless here. But you have never seen poverty as it is in Africa. It will break your heart. It'll make you cry. And perhaps you haven't seen a lot because I'm not ready to write about it yet.
Okay. Did that put you more in touch with the prophetic tradition of the African-American church in particular?
You mean African Methodist Episcopal Church?
Well, yeah, or, but even I think African-American theology in general in the United States has, it's in the Bible, okay, but I mean in terms of churches that have retained that at their core, I think that's more true of African-American theology in the United States, perhaps. Did it awaken that in you or deepen that in you? Or?
I think it... I couldn't say it awakened in me because I felt that I've been at it all along, in the prophetic social gospel tradition, all along, and so it's a continuum. It says, "Yeah, you're right on course. You are, you know, you're right in line. You are, you know, stepping in the right direction in your preaching." In your theology, in your approach to ministry.
So, you know, I do want to ask you about some of the issues that were raised in our culture, but I think not anywhere near resolved around the person of Jeremiah Wright in the context of Barack Obama's presidential campaign. And I know that you have actually a long relationship with Trinity United Church of Christ and with Reverend Wright. And I don't want to talk so much, you know, about him, but about, here's what, you know, one question I'd like to ask you is just how you experienced that, that conflict as it emerged in media. And also, and maybe this prophetic tradition is one thing, you know, what you longed for people to have a better grasp of, to be able to put any of that into context, you know, what people really didn't understand, which muddied anybody's ability to analyze what that meant or what was at stake. I've kind of asked you a bunch of questions there, but we know wherever you'd like to weigh in. Yeah.
Sure. First one was, how was the experience? It was painful. Mm-hmm. It was very, very painful to watch and hear and listen the negative firestorm that came at the end of a successful pastoral ministry. Very painful. And a lot of it was only because Senator Obama was a member of that congregation. Yeah. If it was somebody else, anybody else, I don't believe that kind of attention and that kind of response would have come in his direction. Secondly, I don't think people understand Black theology.
Yeah.
They need to read Cone's books and all the others that, and I think Cone did an excellent job in interviews and others in sharing.
James Cone, right?
James Cone, right? About theology, Black theology. And the reason why I say, you know, it is the lens. In other words, theology is the system through which you evaluate and interpret scripture or ministry and all of that. And then there is a thought of universal theology. In other words, the universal human experience. But for many African Americans and for women, they are not a part of that universal experience. And so the starting point for your interpretation, the starting point for building your theology comes out of the African American experience.
Okay.
Just as womanist theology begins with the woman experience as the starting point of building the lens through which you interpret. So I think a lot of people don't understand it, and there are some people who grabbed it and ran with it in a direction that sort of startled everybody. and there were pastors and preachers who were preaching the same thing and, you know, the same dialogue. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton's pastor said the same thing, but nobody railed him and raked him over the coals. And preacher after preacher and bishop after bishop through the years had preached similar things, but nobody raked them over the coals. And, of course, the thing that was on YouTube that I guess that started the whole ball rolling was not what he was saying. He was quoting someone else,
right,
who was not African American.
Right. I'm just trying to cast my mind back. It was about. It was a critique of American. It was linking the events of September 11th in a broad historical perspective, right, with American actions in the rest of the world. It was
sure.
Right. It was making connections between
right.
events
and
moral
thought.
Culpability. Right. And it wasn't his
right.
thought.
It wasn't his thought. He was
expounding on it.
Mm-hmm. What someone else was, who someone else said from another ethnic position.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Africa for 9/11. And I never feared for my life as an American anywhere in the world. Except for during that season. Serving in Africa for those 4 years, I was able to view the United States through the eyes of someone else other than American media. I found the BBC, the European news, the Chinese news, Al Jazeera, all the other countries, Italian news service, French news service, Spanish news service, you know, able to hear what they said about my country before 9/11 and after 9/11. And in fact, I found out more things about my country that was going on in my country from them than I did from CNN World.
Hmm.
And I'm going like, wow, is this going on? You get on the phone. Hi, how are you? You know, I just heard this, and is this really true? Yeah. Well, then how come it's not on here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, having been a part of broadcasting, you know, you got friends in broadcasting. Well, how come you guys aren't on this story? Wow, I just heard it over here, the Chinese News Service, and how come, you know, I'm looking here, and I'm calling folk back at home. I'm emailing and, you know, yada, 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 and they're not covering this story. How come? You have a totally different picture of your home when you see it through other eyes. And then watching other news services being more objective to the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come home and you get back to the United States, you're home with family and friends and da-da-da-da, and you're watching the media, you're watching American media, you know, covering the same issues and the same story. I was going, wow, this is very subjective.
Okay.
This is not objective at all. This is very subjective. And it's very close to entertainment, you know. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you know, it's like, let us entertain you. And then on the other hand, this is what you have to be afraid of today.
Right. And, okay, so prophetic preaching is the opposite of entertaining.
You're not going to let me talk about this, are you?
No, I am. But I think if you want to come back, if you think I'm derailing you, don't let me. But what I was going to say is what felt inflammatory and I think shocking, jarring, also just because it was so different from what you're talking about, when people heard sections of Jeremiah Wright's sermons on YouTube and really things taken out of context. It was that combination of telling the truth in a new, of seeing things in a different way, but as you say, a way that many preachers have preached, and not just in the Black church, but also the anger and the righteous indignation that is part of the prophetic tradition. And it was that passion attached to the idea that maybe America was morally culpable in the large sweep of history, and maybe there was some connection between that and bad things that were happening to us now, that struck a really emotional nerve in the American psyche of something being almost anti-American, right? I mean, so what did you want people to understand about that kind of preaching and that kind of theology, about the integrity of that?
Well, I think I have to come back.
Okay.
You know, I've got to come back and say that from any pulpit in America, whether the preacher is black, white, Asian, yellow, blue, pink, or green, whatever color, you will hear some strain somewhere, some strain of criticism or opinion about America. You will hear it. I hear it when I listen. When I go through the channels and I listen and I listen and I listen, and I hear a preacher say, you vote for those who believe in your values. Oh, I say, now that's criticism right there. Or you switch the channel and you hear the preacher says, now we're gonna support our troops, right or wrong. Okay. Here's this opinion here. You hear a variety of things, not just in the black church. Mm-hmm. You hear a variety of opinions that support a particular political line, a political bent, a political thing. It's not just in the black church. I'm saying it is in all churches.
Okay.
It's there. You'll hear an opinion. You'll hear a criticism, period. You'll hear it. What happens in America is we have an opinion that we can't do anything wrong, that everything we do is right.
We as a culture.
What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
I'm a journalist. You know, I don't have any opinions.
Yeah, right. but when you write, you broadcast, or when you ask questions, there is an opinion base from which the question comes from,
right.
And so that's where I'm going to jump back to being in Africa during 9/11.
Okay.
And listening to other people talk about your home, your country, the place that you love, where you live, trying to reach home and trying to reach family. Trying to find our kids in the midst of all of this. When you finally get to the television and they're saying that there's a second plane coming and it's going to there's another plane going to Washington and so forth and so on. You're trying to reach your kids. My kids were in college, and I'm calling and they're saying to me, "We're watching the smoke from the Pentagon," and I'm saying, "Get out of there." The school is closed. Yeah, that means you go home, and you get in the car. I can't leave my classmates from California and Oregon because they don't have a place to go. Pile everybody in the car, go home. Don't matter how many kids are there. Just get there. Just get home. Worried about where your husband is, who was a few blocks away from the White House. Where is he? Is he alive? Is he fine? Then you get a call from the U.S. ambassador that says, "Where are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm right here right now." And, "Well, where are you going? Where are you going to go the next day? We need to know where you're going, the name of the congregations you are visiting. We need to know the name of your driver, where you're going. We're going to make sure we have your, cell number." And I said, "Why?" And the response was, "I want to assure you that your government is able to protect you."
All right.
And I'm saying, look at here. When the helicopter takes off from... roof of the embassy, you make two calls, one to your wife, the second one's to me. If y'all got to go. And you have to understand, an American in a foreign country where you have, equal basis between Christians and Muslims, you're not quite sure, about your life. And then the very next day, sitting down with the king of a country where I live, in the capital city, dialoguing with them, who turns around and says, "It seems like y'all having a problem managing your situations." Okay. "But you are sending people to my country." This is what the king says. "You're sending people to my country to teach us about democracy, and your democracy is not working where you live." And I'm going No. Let me tell you a little bit about American history and about my home and where I live. And this king, who was educated in Oxford, you know, educated in Oxford with an Oxford degree in England, comes to tell me about how my country's democracy is not working. Whew. Wow. Who reminds me that they were sending people to Africa to teach them how to set up a democracy government, he said, at a time when you couldn't figure out who was president of the United States. Okay. This is during the 2000 election.
All right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
All of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, wait a minute. Hold on. You know, when you can't figure out who the president of the United States is, you know, and it was a daily dialogue with us. Like, do you have a president yet? You have a president yet? So my response to him was, I said, when you can't elect your prime minister and you fall out, when y'all fall out and you can't elect your leadership, you go to war. You blow up the country. Mm-hmm. When we have an issue, we go to the Supreme Court. There's still a loss of life and money on both sides. There's still bloodshedding. One is in a white-collar mode in the Supreme Court, and the other is through tanks and guns and bombs.
Okay.
Which is the preferred way?
So what's...
Take a deep breath.
Okay. And I want to circle this back to... I mean, so here's the thing. When Americans hear those kinds of opinions in the pulpit that you mentioned before, the other kind of opinion, that we support our troops, right or wrong,
right,
or you vote for, or, you know, from the pulpit telling people to vote for the people who support your values.
Right.
That sounds patriotic. And now what I hear you doing is being patriotic in a very sophisticated and complex way. But I think you're still saying that in the pulpit, it's appropriate to point out that everything is not perfect with American democracy. I mean, yeah. So take what you just said to me and tell me how that, what is the place for that kind of analysis in the pulpit and in preaching, and how that comes together with this prophetic tradition of a Vashti McKenzie, of a Jeremiah Wright.
Well, now I think, you know, the prophetic tradition is one thing. If you're talking about social criticism and whether social criticism has a place in the preaching tradition, yes. Does political criticism, I think that's what you're asking now, whether political criticism belongs in the pulpit. I think you'll find a lot of opinion that says, no, we preach Jesus Christ, him crucified and risen from the grave. You know, that is our mandate. That is the gospel ministry. But to be silent about what's happening in your neighborhood. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. To be silent about what happened in your neighborhood, is that sin? So for me, if I'm in my neighborhood, let's say I'm back in Baltimore, I'm at Payne Memorial, I'm the pastor, and I have 5,000 people who cannot feed their families. And I look up and I've got another 5,000 coming because they're being dropped out of a system, then I'm supposed to be silent and not pick up the phone and call my council representative or my mayor and say, this is what's happening in my neighborhood. What can we do together to fix this?
Okay.
Because in a minute, it's getting ready to be out of hand.
Okay.
And they tell me, well, we made these decisions months ago and years ago. And I said, but you made these decisions and you expect me to feed these people and take care of them and be a part of the safety net system. That means now you're impacting my budget, my tithes and offerings that are going to go from my people to help fix this problem that you created and didn't bother to consult me.
Mm-hmm.
So you want me to shift my budget to be a part of the safety net, because we're going to do that anyway. You know, we're going to demonstrate the love of God in a very tangible way. But I'm supposed to do that silently and not ask questions to see how we can make sure this doesn't happen again.
Okay. Okay. I felt like one issue that was raised but really not addressed in that whole controversy around Jeremiah Wright was the complicated and nuanced relationship we all have with our spiritual leaders or our communities of worship. You know, there was kind of like, well, let's find something alarming that this man's pastor said and equate it with this man himself. And
right.
And I, you know, and it's never that simple. It's not even the way we deal with our sacred text is complex. I just wonder if you had thoughts about that, wisdom about that.
I think the aftermath is that there are going to be fewer politicians in church.
Hmm. Wow, that's a pretty stark statement.
Yeah. Think about it. Where is Senator Barack Obama going to worship now? Mm-hmm. Where?
Right.
Publicly. Is he going to go to worship?
Mm-hmm.
And can you imagine any congregation that he walks near, that pastor is going to have fear and trembling and, oh, my God, they're going to come after me now.
Right, right.
That I'm going to be cyber lynched because this man and family worships in my congregation.
Okay.
Where is any other politician who has aspirations down the line, you know, is going to continue to worship where they worship and say, well, let me see, let me, you know, let Pastor, let me tell you, let's do this. Pastor, let me review every sermon you've preached
right.
over the
well,
last 10
Well, and it
years.
Is happening now with all the candidates, isn't it? It's happening with Sarah Palin's
Absolutely.
Churches. It's happening with John McCain's churches.
Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, not so much. Not so much John McCain. I think he got a pass on that one. I think his pastor got a pass. But, you know, they crucified Dr. Wright. And simply because of that and the fact that Senator Barama was a member of his congregation, I think you're going to have less and less people, politicians who have aspirations, who are going to be in the pews.
Now, I know that, again, you know, as you've been describing, there's a broad spectrum of theology, even if you're talking about, you know, the Black church or the prophetic tradition. Those are also spectrums that people are on. And there were a range of opinions about specific things that Jeremiah Wright said. I don't know, for example, some of the stuff he said about AIDS. Where was I going with that question? But my point also is but even having said that, you know, you're saying that he was crucified, and I mean, is that a sense that many people have, even people who might not have agreed with every, you know, every point, the way every statement was made, the statements that were publicized.
As I said in the beginning, it was very painful. Yeah. It was very painful for those of us who know him and his family, and that Trinity. Very painful, I'm sure, for Senator Obama. And very painful for the Black church as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
For many things were taken out of context. It was blasted all over YouTube and every other place where, under ordinary circumstances, no one would have paid attention outside of those who are you know, related to or who attend or so forth. It was just like a lightning rod, you know, mm-hmm. straight through the community, whether one agreed or didn't agree. It
right.
was just a very painful lightning rod, you know, for the church,
mm-hmm.
for the church individually and for the church as a whole.
Okay. And I want to ask you a similar question to the one I asked at the beginning of this, talking about Jeremiah Wright. I just wonder, there was a point in the primary campaign, and this is when I started thinking about wanting to interview you, where there were suddenly, it was like the notion of being a woman leader, being an African-American leader, somehow there was a competition between the two in a sense. Well, which would be best? And I started thinking about Vashti McKenzie, who is an African-American woman leader, and how you hold all those qualities together in yourself. And I just want to ask you also how you experienced some of the dynamics that were raised about gender and about race in that primary period, how you personally took that in, what disturbed you, what did you feel we weren't really addressing head on?
Well, I still feel that there's still more emphasis on whether one is black or whether one is female, and that our focus should be upon the issue, the program, the platform, the track record, and then again, you know, the things that need to be done to look ahead. I mean, we have issues that need to be dealt with, and they need to be dealt with effectively, mm-hmm. Not only for our future, but for our children's future. You know, we've got domestic issues that are just completely out of hand. You know, today in where we are, between Tennessee and Georgia, people are on a great hunt for gasoline. There's just none to be had. Mm. It's sort of like a foretaste of what can happen and could happen if our economics is going down the tubes anyway. But I mean, you know, if it gets worse than it is for people, we have a domestic policy that is kind of ragged here, and we already know what's happening on Wall Street stock market. Yeah. Our government is bailing out the financial system here, private financial organizations, to keep it from getting worse. But then you wonder who's going to bail out the American government. You begin to wonder, you know, is America for sale? And other countries are coming with their checkbooks to buy what we have allowed to fall apart. So these are very tenuous times in our country, and we're all hoping for the best and the better. So we should not be focusing on whether one is a female or whether one is African American. Let's focus on what they say, they can do, what the policy can be, mm-hmm. How can they perform. That should be the focus. You know, but all across the country, well, we're not going to vote for Senator Obama because we just don't want a black man in the White House.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're gonna vote for McCain because we need to have a woman in the White House.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Let's vote for the person who we believe is qualified and is ready to lead the country, and let's put them in place, and let's put the gender and the race issue aside. But we get hung up on it every time we turn the corner, over and over and over again. And I live for the day. I live for the day. I said it in my books, and, you know, you sound like you've been reading them.
Yeah,
you know,
yes.
I said it, you know, I said over and over again, I live for the day when my gender and my race means nothing about whether I'm qualified to do a job or perform a task. That my gifts, my skills, my character, my mental astuteness, these things is what gets me in the door, not whether I'm female or not whether I'm African American, not whether I'm from the Asian Pacific Rim, not whether I'm Hispanic or Latino, but my gifts, my skills, my graces, these things qualify me to do the job. Period.
You often write about, you know, leaders who happen to be women. And I mean, I can imagine you also have leaders who happen to be African-American or happen to be Latino.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, when the ship is sinking, you know, and you're going down for the third time, okay, you know, you're not going to, you know, somebody's getting ready to cast a net to say, you know, I can pull this ship out of the water and all of you will live. Are you going to stand there and take time and say, are you African-American? You know, what's your heritage? What's your parentage?
Right.
You just want to get, you want to get saved. You want to live. You want to get out of the rough waters here. Mm-hmm. You don't want to drown. You're not going to stop and ask for a resume.
Right. And you also have a very developed theology around this. I mean, one of your books centers around the Samaritan woman at the well. And, you know, here's one of the ways you talk about that. You write, the first lesson from the well is that the petty distinctions of race and gender used to divide kingdoms and communities are not valid in the eyes of God. Jesus becomes a catalyst for change, upsetting our set of beliefs, attitudes, assumptions, and expectations. The Samaritan woman needed water to survive, but Jesus startled her by affirming her humanity.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yay! Let's put it on a T-shirt. Let's put it on a billboard.
You know, talk a little bit for people who aren't familiar with that story. Why, for you, this Samaritan woman at the well is such a compelling figure in this context of race and gender?
Well, for the first time, of course, it's in the fourth chapter of the Gospel of John. This woman who comes to an outside well has an encounter with Jesus that changes her life. And at the end of the story, she drops her water pots. She came to get water. At the end, she dropped her water pots and went back to the city and announced, "Come see a man who's told me everything about myself." It's a simple story, and most people approach it as a simple story. To me, it is a multi-layered experience, an occasion that sets a pattern of transformation that can happen for all of us, a pattern and a moment of transformation. Here you find Jesus meeting in foreign territory. He's in hostile territory now.
Okay.
He is in a place where if he is found by people who are not of his ilk, he will put himself in harm's way. He can be physically attacked and forcibly removed from the area because the Jews and the Samaritans didn't kind of like each other, didn't quite get along. They had similarities, but there was divisions along the way. So here you have a woman who is of Samaria, who is outside of her neighborhood. There was a city well that she could have gone to, but she went at the wrong time of the day and the wrong hour, which already announces that something is amiss in her life. Mm-hmm. She has an encounter with Jesus, who begins to dialogue with her about what she knows. He doesn't tell her to come to Sunday school or sits down and does a Bible study or exegetes a text. What he does is he begins with where she is and what she knows, and that's water. And he begins to lead her from a very basic understanding of physical water by explaining a very complicated theological concept of living water. And so in this encounter is the demonstration of the beloved community. This is a demonstration of those who absolutely on the outside, got character issues here, has a past that is just, yeah, off the radar screen as the appropriate radar screen. I mean, just way off. And Jesus talks with her and then leads her to a transformation, to a woman who doesn't know what's going on, to a woman who does know what's going on. Yeah. And so she sees herself reflected in the eyes of Jesus as who she really is. Her history has defined who she is. Her gender has defined who she is and her role in her community. Her culture has defined her as being secluded and silent. Her religion has defined her. She's a person without a soul. And her personal situation has defined her. She's on this relationship merry-go-round here, this relationship roulette. And so all of these things have defined who she is. But for that one shining moment, she saw who she really was reflected in the eyes of God. And then at that moment, Jesus reveals to her his messiahship, not to the disciples, not to the religious leaders of the temple. She was the first one in John's gospel to receive this revelation. Mm-hmm. Isn't that wonderful? Mm. So when we take a look at this pattern of transformation, then what I want to do, I want to see myself reflected in the eyes of God. I know what my history and my heritage tells about me. I know what my social standing and status in this country tells me who I am. But I want to see myself reflected in the eyes of God. And when I see myself reflected in the eyes of God, then doors open. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. There's neither Greek nor Jew, bond nor free, male nor female. We are all one in Christ Jesus. When I see myself reflected in the eyes of Christ, I know that every good and perfect gift comes from God. that as I humble myself before the Lord will lift me up. So when I see myself, I see myself reflected in the eyes of God, that I'm a child of God. I am not superior. I am not inferior. I am a child of God.
Okay. I think I just should say amen here and
yeah,
not ask another erudite question.
And we can open the doors of the church.
On public radio. Listen, I'm going to pause for a minute and see if there are questions from my colleagues behind the glass, and then I'm just going to ask you a few more questions and let you go. You've given me a lot of time, and this is really wonderful. So I'm going to be quiet for a minute in my headphones while I listen to them.
Sure.
Yeah, she did that.
What did I do?
She didn't give the name of the book.
Oh, Journey to the Well. Oh, okay.
She talked about it, but nobody knows the name of it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay. All right. Just want to get a little more understanding. When you said earlier on, and I think we kind of passed over this, just because we ended up talking about some of the media conflict and the political conflict. We talked about that Jeremiah Wright, and you said people couldn't understand a lot of that because they don't understand black theology. Would you want to say a little bit more about what you mean by that? What is not, perhaps not even possible for outsiders to understand?
Well, I'm not saying that I don't think it is impossible for outsiders to understand. I think that if you want to know what it is, then go read about it. And, you know, go read God of the Oppressed by James Cohen. Go read about it first before you take something out of context and criticize it. And I think it's time for us to let it go. It's time to let this go.
Yeah.
It's like a bone. We keep gnawing on it, and we keep gnawing on it, and keep gnawing on it. It's just,
you mean the Jeremiah Wright thing?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I mean, you know, it's just time. You know, it's just time to let it go.
Okay. I think I want to. You talk a lot in your books about it's important for you for people to think for themselves about what are societal defining moments for them. And I just love to know what your perspective is, you know, in these years we're in now. Because I have a feeling you may not give the obvious answers. You know, what are the societal defining moments that you see, that you're experiencing, that are going to shape us as we move forward, well beyond, you know, this year, this presidential election and the crises of today?
I think that you're referring to, when I talk about defining moments, things that happen
are happening in the world,
so that things are different after that moment happens. Mm-hmm. They have impact upon your life, so that how you were living prior to it was changed by that moment, so that you live differently after that. Like for one generation, World War II was a defining moment. For many, the Vietnam War was a defining moment. Certainly for me, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a defining moment for me. And I think in this era, this election, whoever wins, it's going to be a defining moment. Mm. I believe that because there's so many young people, hooray, 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 who are waking up, who have been content to let other people make decisions for them, who are waking up and who are working and volunteering and getting excited. And there's going to be one group that's disappointed. And my fear is that they would just throw up their hands and walk away.
Yeah.
And that they're unable to handle it. And I would hate for that to happen. I would hope that whichever side, whatever it is, that they would use that disappointment to continue to participate and to work and to volunteer and, of course, to vote and to vote. I think for many, many, many families, the conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan is going to be a defining moment. Mm-hmm. Recently, my husband and I were flying, and there were a lot of troops on the plane. And what they do is they allow their families to come down to the gate so that you can, you know, hug and hold for the last mm-hmm. possible moment. And, you know, sitting next to a soldier on his way to Afghanistan, and I just looked at him and I said, please come back. just come back. Just please come back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he looks at me and I'm looking at him. We know exactly what we're talking about. But his life, that will be a defining moment for his life. Now, watching him hug his wife and his kids, it's a defining moment for those children, especially if something happens. Right. And so conflict on the other side of the world is going to be a defining moment for many people. I think for our young people who are coming along, defining moments are going to be the brick walls that they're hit. That they're going to hit and are not prepared to handle it.
What about Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath of that? You know, when that was unfolding, I felt like that was a defining moment. I felt like Americans, we saw something about ourselves, because what we saw in New Orleans was not just about New Orleans. It was about American urban areas and somehow about how disconnected we've become from each other. But I, you know what, as that has receded into the past, I can't tell that that stuck, that moment of whatever we learned in Katrina. What's your perspective on that?
Racism is alive and well and living in New Orleans. You know, racism is alive and well and living in America. Yes, Katrina, it's a defining moment. We watched with horror and, you know, worked as hard as we could to try to alleviate as much pain as we can. 11 tractor trailers left my district and went to Mississippi and Louisiana, filled with clothes and water and all those kinds of things from our district, from our two states. And so we did what we could. One of the things, the whole issue just... for me, was painful. It was traumatic. It was absolutely like I was living there. I grew up in hurricane territory. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Baltimore. Hurricanes, you know, Hurricane Anna, Camille, they all came right up Chesapeake Bay. And so I know what it's like. I know what it felt like. And to watch the dehumanizing process of Hurricane Katrina was just absolutely painful. And so not only did we respond, we were upset about some of the coverage that happened. Yes, we were upset that, you know, the things, you know, the FEMA things and things that were supposed to be in mm-hmm. place were not there, and that people were falling between the cracks and people were dying. And, you know, the deplorable situation that was at the Superdome, and people were left stranded on bridges and in their homes and all of that. And the safety net that was supposed to be there, the responders who were supposed to be there, it just did not happen right away. And then the structure, you're talking about the administration, yeah. The structure of the process was flawed, so that you had people who came to help. Couldn't help, who just sat and helped, you know. You know, I was in Memphis and saw, tractor trucks loaded with ice, supposed to be going down south, and say, why aren't you going? Hmm. And their response is, we're waiting for them to tell us where to go. So you had all of this, it's similar that's happening to Ike when the mayor of Houston yeah. says, you know, we have all these people in line for food on this side of town, and you have all this food that's in a parking lot over here. Something is the matter with the structure, how it's set up and how do people respond. So as a media child as I am, we put a film crew, sent a film crew 2 weeks after Katrina. Hmm. down to capture the truth. We called It's called, it's a 30-minute program. It's called Survivor Stories. I'd be happy to share it with you. We wanted to be able to show the response of the African-American church community to what was happening in Katrina.
Because that wasn't that was being told? Is that what? That was not a story that was being told.
That was not a story being told. And so, we're watching and you know, we knew the churches. We knew what they were doing. We knew what the people were doing on the ground. But you didn't see it on the day program, mm-hmm. didn't see it on an early mm-hmm. show, didn't see it on CNN. And we're going like, wow, wait a minute. What it looked like our own community was not responding to help our community.
Okay.
It looked like that we abandoned. We abandon our own community. And that's not what was happening.
Okay.
We wanted to show that, yes, we were on the ground and we were there and our churches were open and the people were sleeping in the sanctuary and the food and we were sending food and clothes and we were responding to the community. But what I wanted to be sure is that the stories of the people did not get lost.
Okay.
Here are people who went through a hurricane hell. They went through something that you would not want your worst enemy to go through.
Yeah.
And they survived. And so I wanted to find out, how were you able to survive? How were you able to do that? Hmm. What was your anchor? What helped you to hold on? And so we had stories, story of a man, and they're, stuck in the house and the water is now up to the second floor. And how he took one family member at a time and took them underwater, carried them on his back up the street to a place where he could plant them on the roof of another place so that they'd be safe. 9 family members. A mother who had to do the same thing with each of her children, having had 3 children. And can you imagine, telling the 5-year-old, you stay here, mommy be back?
No, I can't.
Yeah. And mommy takes the child out. I don't know. We didn't want these stories to be lost because we felt somewhere along the line, 20 years from now, someone's going to come along and says, oh, Katrina wasn't that bad.
Okay.
This didn't really happen.
All right.
And we wanted to preserve these stories and show how the African-American community responded, and we were able to do that.
Finally, I want to ask, and again, thinking about some of these great challenges we have ahead of us, not just this election, but the challenges that are going to be with us very much the day after the election as well for whoever is elected president. You've learned a lot about leadership in your years. You've written about leadership. You've kind of deconstructed what is involved. You've talked about how our ideas of leadership have evolved. And I just wonder what kind of wisdom you have to offer as you help all of us think about what leadership means in this world we're inhabiting now, in this world we're moving into.
Things are changing so rapidly that leaders are having to learn on their feet. And the learning curve is very short.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that it's not just the skill or the experience of the leader that's going to be the telling mark. It's going to be the character. And it's going to be what the leader believes in. The belief, the value base, it's what's going to count later on. And I think the belief and the value base is going to be the best barometer, on how they're going to come out at the other end. I believe that there are leaders who are wrestling, who are having a great wrestling match with what the world is going to become. Our world is very small now, and it's going to be a very diverse world. And we're going to have to live in a world community of different races, different histories and heritage, and different religions.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to learn how to live together. Because if we don't, we're going to start to wipe each other off the face of the earth. And I sure would hate that to happen. I would hate to have to hand to my children and to my children's children a world that has turned on each other. And so as a leader, you have to get over it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you have a particular phobia against a particular history, it's time to get over this because we're going to live in this world together. If you have a particular phobia where you cannot stand in a room of persons from a variety of religions. You need to get over it mm-hmm. now. And very quickly.
And I think, you know, there are people and there are reasons for people to believe this, that religion precisely gets in the way of people being embracing towards different others. And I wonder what your understanding of God, your theology, teaches you about leadership for this world we inhabit now.
We can learn about the leadership process through many of the biblical, you know, through the biblical characters that have been left for us to examine. But for me, the transformational style, leadership style of Jesus is just an absolute wonderful role model who is able to bring people from the fringes of community and empower them. Who looks beyond history and culture and society and brings people together and helps them to find a common ground. And isn't that a wonderful thing for faith to do, faith leaders to do? Hmm. I think that we agree on more things than we disagree, except for we disagree so hard about stuff we disagree about.
Right.
We overlook the things that we do agree about. So I'm all for let's find our common ground. Okay, we agree on this. Good. Now let's begin to build our relationship from there.
Okay. Anything else that's on your mind, questions or insights, answers, wisdom, right now, this moment in time, as this election nears?
This is a most exciting time to be alive in the world. We are right on the cusp of moving into new directions. We are learning, moving from this information, from this industrial age to this information age, which is changing all of our relationships. Mm-hmm. The technology, the internet, is changing how we relate to each other. And I don't think we have realized the impact upon our human relationships, this new technology, which is changing every day,
right.
day. And I think the church is the last place where we're going to learn how to relate to each other as human beings. It's the last place where we learn about relationships, our parenting relationships, our personal relationships, our relationships between God and community and each other. This is an exciting time to be alive.
You mean it's the last place? It's one of the last places where that is what we focus on. Is that what you're saying?
Where it's mm-hmm. taught, mm-hmm. where it's preached, where it's taught, where you learn it, where you're in Sunday school. Mm-hmm. We don't do it in school anymore.
Yeah, it's intergenerational too in churches.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. On how we relate to each other. So. Mm-hmm. It is an exciting time in this emerging technology and how it relates. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But for me, I remember very vividly my dad, and I wrote about it. You probably came across the story already. My dad, big guy, 6'4", 200-pound guy, you know, AAU track champion out of the University of Wisconsin, big guy. Your daddies are always a little girl's hero. And I vividly watched my dad watching the dogs and the hoses leech released on people who were in the freedom marches down south with tears coming down his eyes. And I was a little girl, and he turned to me and he says, "Never let anybody ask you what you did for your people and for your country." And so I never want my children to ask me, "What did you do?" I want them to be able to see it. Hmm. And I hope every adult who is living and alive today will be able to do something to improve where we live and who we are, so that when you turn around and hand this world to your children, you will not be ashamed.
Okay, that's your last word. We have one question about music, because we layer the program with music. You talked about songs that you sang in that you memorized when you were a little girl in church. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What were, do you know or do you remember what some of those songs were?
Well, let's see. Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine.
Yeah.
You know, those those kinds of songs. The Church is One Foundation, you know. On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand.
Yeah.
All Other Ground is Sinking Sand.
Yeah.
And then, of course, It Is Well With My Soul.
Yes.
When Sea Like a River, you know, that
one.
It is, you know, the, It Is Well With My Soul. Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, quick question.
Amazing Grace, you know, all those songs.
All those, okay. Mm-hmm. Do you have any audio of you as a gospel announcer? Do you have any tapes left from that time?
I don't know. I'll have to go search for them. You know, that was a that was before the digital age.
I know. Well, we could work with cassette. We could work with reel to reel. Yeah, and you know what we're saying? We can offer you a deal. If you can find it on in any medium, we can turn it into a CD for you.
Oh, okay.
We can make it worth your time.
We'd have to, I would really have to search, and I'm not in a, this is my annual conference season, so I'm going from region to region to region here. And those tapes would be back in Baltimore.
Is there some place we could look for them? Are they in, are they stored somewhere that we might be able to make a connection?
I don't know. We would have to find it from the radio station, really.
Is the radio station still there?
Yes.
What is it?
WYCB in Washington.
Okay, we'll try that. Bishop McKenzie, thank you so much. It has been really an honor and a delight to speak with you. And we'll let you know what's happening with this, and we'll send you a CD, and I hope you'll like it.
All right, and please let us know when it's airing.
Yeah, we will. We absolutely will.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Dave.